Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. So what's the best exercise? What should you eat? How much sleep do you really need? Questions like these have spawned thousands of blogs, advice columns, books, and videos about how to have a healthier, calmer, less stressful life. Now, my next guest, James Hamblin, knows a lot about these complicated questions. He's a medical doctor turned journalist who hosts a web series for The Atlantic called If Our Bodies Could Talk. Now he's published a book by the same name in which he answers dozens of questions, from how much sleep we need to whether wine is good for you to why men have nipples. James Hamblin will be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight, and he joins us now in the studio as well as on Facebook Live. And James Hamblin, welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I've really been having fun jumping around this book. Now, we want to invite our listeners into this conversation. What's your burning question about your health? How your body works, diet, sleep, food supplements, coffee, and alcohol. How do you find your way through the maze of blogs and books about health? What's your question for Dr. James Hamblin? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter and at Radio Boston. Let me start with just this particular question that I made reference to, and that is this maze of writing and blogs and books about issues having to do with health, so many fads out there. What did you want to add to that sort of maze of literature with this book?
Yeah, I thought there was just too much out there, so why don't I solve the problem by adding to it?
Right, of course.
I think there are a lot of question and answer books about body trivia and a lot of lifestyle health books out there. And it seems like a lot of them have their different philosophy, their different solution, often a silver bullet for how you should eat, how you should exercise, how to sleep. And so I tried to just kind of sift through a lot of the different ideas out there and try to figure out where we actually know things and can be informed and where there's a lot of ambiguity and we need to embrace it.
Yeah. Now, you write, one of the things that I found in this book, you write, many of the answers in this book are stories about why we don't have concrete answers. You say that sometimes the most interesting thing is knowing why we don't know, and the point is in the considering and being comfortable in not knowing. Health is a balance between acceptance and control. I like that paragraph a lot, but I'd love you to expand on it a little bit, especially this idea being comfortable both in knowing and not knowing.
Yeah. I guess a good example of that is, I mean, a lot of people, when you're diagnosed with any sort of medical condition, be it diabetes, cancer, all kinds of different things that we have good frameworks for scientifically as to how they're working at a biological, at a cellular level, and what makes people more likely to get them. But it's hard to ever trace these things back to exactly what was the cause, what was the moment. Almost never is it a single particular gene or a single incident of which cigarette caused this to happen. It's this complex milieu of conditions and the way we live and the genes we inherited and every daily decision that we make. And a lot of people, when they're in dire situations, want to look back and point a finger at one thing.
At one thing, right. It seems like, too, we also want to believe, and I think you made mention of this earlier, to sort of one silver bullet. I mean, for example, when it comes to diet, there are diet fads, whether it's the paleo diet or fat is good, fat is bad. I mean, and I guess one of the answers that sort of comes out of that is it's not one size that fits all, right?
Right, right. Which diet is a great example of some place where it seems like you're hearing a lot of competing, conflicting messages, and we in the media tend to be guilty of that too, because you know what makes a good story is something that's upending conventional wisdom, something that's changing the way you thought about everything, and that's just not the way science works. It's at odds with this idea that we do learn new things, but it grows slowly and incrementally, and ultimately you make decisions based on a body of evidence that grew over years, decades. which is harder to make a headline out of.
That's right. We're talking to Dr. James Hamblin. He's a senior editor of The Atlantic. His book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. He'll be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight. And you can join this conversation by giving us a call at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook Live if you want to follow this conversation on Facebook. Let's go to Katie, who's calling from Wellesley with a question about alcohol. Hi, Katie.
Hi. Hello, doctor. My question is, am I helping or hurting myself by having, say, 3 glasses of red wine a week?
Oh, I can answer that. You're helping yourself, obviously. No, go ahead, doctor.
We think that sounds to me like it's within the range, which for most people would be healthy. But the most data that we know about that comes from studies where you look at huge populations and you say, the longest lived, healthiest people in the world, what are they eating? And often we see low to moderate consumption of alcohol being part of that. But the experts also mostly say that if you aren't drinking, if you don't drink at all, there's no reason to start to introduce it. So low to moderate seems to be fine. Also, nothing at all seems to be fine.
All right, Katie, thanks for that. I want to ask you a little bit about sleep, because you've written a lot about sleep. And you start by talking about your experience with sleep deprivation when you were a medical resident, and you work shifts that lasted 36 hours. And you sort of make the point that, what was that like? And what did you learn about what the lack of sleep does to a human body?
Yeah. Well, lots of stories about that. Technically, they were 30-hour shifts. That's the mandatory limit.
Yeah.
But just the nature of the work in the hospital, people keep getting sick. There's always someone else who needs you, and you don't want to abandon your team, so people ended up staying longer a lot of the time. I think once you've put yourself to that extreme of sleep deprivation, for me, it took that extreme to realize the importance of sleep in my cognitive functioning, and to realize, yeah, that you can simply space things. There's a time I read about in the book where I just found myself in a very serious situation, talking about transferring a patient to the ICU, talking with their family about an advanced directive, and I remember laughing, and it was just mortifying. I had to hide it, but it was not funny. I was not thinking.
So it was just sort of sleep deprivation, giddiness.
It was
almost
a little bit of delirium, really. It was scary. And the underlying point of the researchers that I spoke to about sleep kept telling me is you don't really appreciate your own how incapacitated you are when you're sleep deprived.
Right. Which leads to the question, how much sleep do we actually need? I mean, is there a golden number that we should all sort of have in our minds?
Right. That's the challenge of public health, is trying to make recommendations for groups of people and at the same time recognizing that everyone is unique. But when the best reviews of all the research out there tend to put the answer at 7 hours for people. And yet we know that there's a very small number of people who do just fine on much, much less.
Much less. You know, I talked to a sleep expert a few years back when I was having some sleep problems. And he said, it's a mistake to think about everyone needing the same amount of sleep, just as it is to, in the same way that some people are tall, some people are short, some people need 10 hours of sleep, and there's nothing wrong with that if they need it. And some people can do just fine on 4.5 hours of sleep, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. It seems so there's also value in the behavioral psychology of having a number, a goal in mind. So everyone is probably slightly different, but we do tend to cluster in our need around that 7 hour mark.
Let's take some more calls for Dr. James Hamblin. His book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. Let's go to Una, who's calling from Cambridge. Hi, Una.
Hi, Anthony and Dr. Hamblin. My question is about muscle building. So I'm a vegetarian, so I can't really get protein from whole foods that easily. So I've been seeing a lot of people online say, like, you should take protein powder. But I was just wondering, is it bad for you because it's unnatural, or, like, should you keep the dosage under a certain amount, and is there differences from men and women for how much you can have?
Protein powder.
That there are a lot of questions to be answered there. I think the first one is the basic premise, and I think a lot of nutritionists would tell you that you can get plenty of protein on a vegetarian or vegan diet. You have to work a little harder at it given the food system that we live in and meat and cheese being all around us, but you can do it, and it's rarely necessary to supplement with protein, and that actually a lot of people are just excreting the protein that they're buying in powders. But as for specific safety concerns, I'm not aware of them. It's more just a concern of potentially wasting money.
Yeah, I mean, you write, first of all, I want to just put the number out again. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to make the connection with Dr. James Hamblin. You also write about these food supplements as being a little bit of a hoax in many cases. So tell me about your concerns about this industry. And maybe beginning with exactly what we mean by food supplements.
Right. It started out a long time ago when people realized that sailors were getting scurvy if they didn't have vitamin C, discovered what vitamin C was, and thought, well, you know, what if we could isolate something like that and that would be a supplement? You don't have to actually suck on a lime like sailors were doing, but just the vitamin C. So it was sort of a logical extension of this is something that would have come in your food and you can take it without. And now it has become a big umbrella term for all kinds of different compounds and not just a multivitamin, but all kinds of different herbs and extracts and combinations of different vitamins in huge doses.
Not regulated, right?
Yeah. The industry does not like saying that they're not regulated. There are ways to, if you find that a product has been tainted, has been harming people, it will be recalled and removed from the shelf. So we have that retroactive safety, but it's very different from the pharmaceutical industry where things have to be tested and prove at least somewhat effective before going to market.
Yeah, yeah. But in general, your view is there a bit of a scam being waged out there?
There is a much lower bar for what can be said about these products, the claims they can make on labels. Mm-hmm. It's stuff we want to believe. If you take something that says it's going to promote heart health or, you know, there's this, it's an easy sell, and a lot of them are not substantiated and could be a waste of money. Sometimes could be potentially harming us. We don't know.
Let's go to Tina, who's calling from Acton. Hi, Tina. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is about the body and aging. I had a horseback riding accident when I was in high school, and now I'm in my 60s. What kind of reasonable expectation should I feel about, you know, the aging process and injury, because I've had pain there on and off in my hip all my life. Is it going to increase? Should I do more yoga exercises?
I'm sorry to hear that. This is one where, you know, you'd have to take it on a case-by-case basis, and I'd refer you to hopefully you have a good relationship with a family physician and physical therapist who can help with that. And the general recommendation is to exercise and stretch as long as your body can handle it. But if there's a specific injury, you don't want to exacerbate that. So that has to be the case-by-case basis.
Tina, thanks for the call, and good luck with those old injuries. We wish you well. Let's go to Jerry, who's calling from Concord. Jerry, you're on the air.
Thank you. I've been trying to just stay healthy by doing slow jog for many years, and I've settled on about 40 miles a week is what I thought works for me. I never try and race, never try and go fast. But the last few years, I'm getting disproportionately slower every year, and I don't understand why. I mean, I've gone from 9-minute miles up to like 14-minute miles, and my weight's the same, and my diet's the same, and I hang in there. It just seems like too big a change, and yet whenever I talk to the doctor, he says, well, you know, you're getting older.
You don't want to accept that, Jerry?
I'm jogging the 40 miles a week to fight that. Is it just age? Is there nothing I can do here?
What do you think, James?
Yeah, I'd have to defer to your doctor on that too. I know that there is an inevitable decline in our performance, and that sounds like a relatively rapid one. But I'd have to trust your doctor in saying there's not something else.
But James, just following up on Jerry's conversation, I mean, what happens to the body as we age? I mean, in sort of understanding how this body performs, if our bodies could talk, what's Jerry's body saying to him as it ages?
Yeah, that's an interesting. if you're to take the title of the book literally, and often your body might be telling you to slow down and to not to run 40 miles a week. Yet we know that there's a certain point where you need to push yourself a little bit.
Yeah.
Exercise is one of those. You can certainly overdo it, but we know that long term, if you can live and generally active lifestyle, you'll have more healthy years.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking to Dr. James Hamblin. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic. His book is called If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. He'll be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight discussing his book and signing copies. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call right now. I want to ask you a little bit about your career. You're a radiologist by training. What led you away from practicing medicine to writing about health?
Well, I did 2 years of radiology residency, so I never actually practiced as an attending physician. At the time, I got the opportunity to work with The Atlantic, and I just really enjoyed writing, and this has been a nice marriage of my creative instincts and curiosity about the world and all these questions that are still unanswered. And so I took this job with The Atlantic and have been writing now for 5 years and haven't gone back, but the future is wide open.
It's wide open. So you might go back and be a practicing physician one of these days?
Oh, I never want to stop writing.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that could be the part.
All right. More questions from listeners. Let's go to Steve, who's calling from Needham. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question has to do with artificial sweeteners. They seem to have come in waves. There was like NutraSweet from like way back in the day, and then more recently there was Sucralose and the Splenda brand. And then we've got extracts from plants like stevia and monk fruit now. I'm wondering if all of those are the same, if they're all bad, if some of them are good, or if all of them are better than sugar, or if there's some sort of, you know, thing about all of them that we haven't quite got figured out. Do they interact with the mouth differently than the stomach and the pancreas and all of that?
All right. Great question about artificial sweeteners there, Doctor.
Yeah. I think I could write a book on that right now. and just like anything, just like when you're talking about supplements, just like when you're talking about pharmaceuticals, yeah, each one of these is going to have its own properties, its own potential concerns, its own potential benefits. If you have to break it down to a simple rule of thumb, most nutritionists will say treat it like a crutch. If you're trying to get yourself off of, you know, drinking a lot of soda, transition to the diet, but don't be having it with every meal every day. And that's not because of clear, definite cause for concern about health risks, but just generally moderation is the way to go when we're in doubt about these things as we learn more.
General moderation in general is the approach. I want to ask you, I'm looking at some of your chapter headings, so I want to ask you about eggs versus oatmeal. And this is interesting to me because it gets to this point about how these fads change. I mean, I have distinct memory as a kid. And so I grew up in the sort of 60s, 70s era. And I remember my parents, my father in particular, being a real believer in protein, protein, protein. And he would make us eat eggs in the morning. You have to have eggs, eggs, eggs. And then, you know, we went through this phase where, no, eggs are bad. Eggs are full of cholesterol and, you know, you got to have oatmeal. And now suddenly eggs are back. And I'm sort of delighted that eggs are back. But where should we be in this eggs versus oatmeal quandary?
Yeah, yeah. Part of that is that the science on nutrition has progressed as science does in a way that initially some people, when nutrition science was very young decades ago, some people believed that saturated fat was a major, maybe the major driver of heart disease. And then as new studies emerged, recommendations have changed. We're not as concerned about it. Some people are not concerned about it at all. So it can be confusing, and it's partly exacerbated by media stories, which tend to be thinking about saturated fat is all good, or it's all, or just eat as much of it as you want. Mm-hmm. And people who want to interpret it that way. But the message all along, really, I think, if you look for a consistent theme, there's been moderation, balance. Things that are easier said than done. But
so maybe an egg on Monday and Wednesday and Friday and some oatmeal on Tuesday and Thursday.
And we also have to look at the sustainability of how these foods are produced and how
right.
we feed the growing population.
All right, let's go to Jasmine, who's calling from Winchester. Hi, Jasmine, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is around resting heart rate. I have a Fitbit that measures my resting heart rate every morning. And the claim is that that's a reflection of the health of your heart. Is that true?
Yeah, it tends to be that when there's variation within the population of what people's resting heart rates are, but when a certain person starts working out more, you can lower your resting heart rate. So generally, that is a true thing.
So resting heart, so a low resting heart rate, a good thing.
Often.
Yeah.
Often a good thing, not necessarily.
I think we've got time for one or maybe two more questions. Let's go to Diane, who's calling from Scituate. Hi, Diane, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I would like to ask the doctor about his opinion of probiotics. You talked about protein powders and the marketing and how we're, getting ripped off. I was wondering about probiotics. It seems to be such a trend. You go into CVS and there's hundreds to choose from now. So what is your opinion on taking or not taking probiotics?
Dr. Hamlin, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a trend that you're going to see more and more and more of over the years. We've only recently come to appreciate that there are more microbes in our bodies than there are human cells, and we want to optimize those populations and that they're intimately tied to health. So then immediately there's a flood of products that are saying that they can do that. But right now we know that everyone's populations are very different, and we don't exactly know how to manipulate those populations in any specific way. So an analogy is sort of like reaching into a bag that says seeds and then going over to a park and throwing them into the park and thinking, is this going to be good for the ecosystem there? And you don't know what the seeds are, if they're going to take, if it's going to create an invasive species, if it's going to do nothing, most likely do nothing. Yeah.
So, James Hamlin, we only have 30 or 40 seconds left or so. So let me just sort of close by sort of asking you finally, in writing this book, If Our Bodies Could Talk, how do you hope people will start thinking differently about their bodies, about their health? What's the sort of core underlying message here?
I hope that it equips people to deal with this new information-heavy age where the patient-physician relationship has shifted in a way that everyone is diagnosing themselves and coming into their doctors with a stack of papers they printed out and they're pretty sure what they have, and then these new news stories every day, and it's just a lot to deal with. And so I think thinking about the history of medicine and science can help inform and make us comfortable dealing with this new information as it hits us day after day.
All right. Well, the book is If Our Bodies Could Talk, A Guide to Operating and Maintaining a Human Body. Dr. James Hamblin, he's senior editor of The Atlantic, and he'll be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight discussing his book. And James Hamblin, real pleasure. Thanks for coming in. We're very grateful.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. Boston's NPR news station. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.